This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Live and Learn. I'm Chua Entik. Today is World Press Freedom Day. This year's theme is Critical Minds for Critical Times, media's role in advancing peaceful, just and inclusive societies. One person who has been trying to do this is freelance journalist Jules Rahman Ong. His effort to document the plight of the Tamil community in Kelantan got him arrested earlier this year. Since September, 200 Tamil villagers have been setting up blockades near Guamusang to end logging activities that have been taking place on their ancestral homelands for decades. The documentary called Fighting for My Home was released on Channel News Asia, and here is a trailer.
Kelantan, the eastern state of Malaysia, is being stripped by the logging industry. But with the state depending heavily on timber for revenue, the only active protesters are the Orang Asli.
Tak ada binatang dah. Dan lagi pun tempat ni untuk nak berteduh, pokok pun tak ada. Dah musnah.
The indigenous people are risking it all to protect their homes and livelihood.
We hope that the court will agree that the Orang Asli is the real people who have been in occupation and in actual possession of the place.
Get Real finds out what's really at stake.
Cipta ri, kuasa ri, nak menjadi lebih. And anu lah nak jadi narusak at that day.
Jules Ong, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
So that was a very fast turnover, because the film was released in Singapore in February and internationally after that. How long did you take to put it together?
All in all, about a month and a half. So it was a very quick turnaround. And during that 1.5 months, commencing from production, shooting to post-production, I fell sick for 2 weeks. So in essence, actually 1 month. But I have a lot to thank the producers of Channel News Asia, who helped a lot in the scripting process.
So you went into this without a clear story in mind. You just went in to see what it's about.
I had an idea of what I wanted to do, which I pitched to Channel News Asia. I wanted to document the story about the Tamiya Orang Asli blockades, who are trying to protect the forest from being logged. So the story was about that, actually, from their viewpoint. And also linking that to the terrible floods that has been happening in Kelantan yearly, and I think it's getting worse. So the story is basically about the connection between the deforestation, the floods, and with the Orang Asli, the Tamiyas, as the primary stakeholder in this whole saga.
Why the Tamiya as the protagonist, I guess, for this documentary?
Well, I learned about the blockades through the papers, actually, sometime in September. And I think I felt that to go through the Tamiyas, who were the protectors or the forest were their homes, I think it's a powerful story to go through their viewpoint as people who lived there and who had to suffer direct consequences of the logging practices that was going on in there.
So in the course of doing this story, you were arrested on January 24th by forestry officials. What happened that day?
Actually, a few days prior to that, we heard that there was going to be a blockades demolition by the forestry officials. So I felt that that was quite integral to the story that I was doing. And I wanted to film that in action. I've seen from YouTube videos of the standoff between the Orang Aslis and the forestry officials when they were going to demolish the blockades. They were mainly filmed by the Orang Aslis through their smartphones. They weren't filmed very well. So I thought integral to that story is to see that happening, you know. So we waited for a few days for that to happen. And then it was raining. And then the forestry officers didn't come, so we waited a few days. So on that day, we saw the cars of the forestry officials' cars coming in. So we knew that was going to happen that day, and we actually stationed ourselves at the blockade area, hoping to catch that standoff. But we were surprised that It was raining a little bit, but the Orang Aslis, having had the experience of having their blockades demolished a few times before, this time they weren't there. It was just us. It was just me and my cameraman, a few others, those diehards, you know, like, those leaders. So that's kind of a dramatic standoff. Didn't happen, you know, it was just us. So we saw the forestry department officers coming in. And the moment they came to the blockade, they just surrounded us and they yelled at us, verbally abused us. I felt that that was very uncalled for.
Did they know who you were? As in, you were a journalist instead of someone who's trying to enforce that blockade?
I think they knew because one of them, the head of the group, told us that he was already tracking us. He had pictures of us while we were doing our job in Gua Musang in the town. And they knew very well that we were journalists and we were not there to harm the forest, to poach animals. You know, our equipment went for that. You know, we had a camera, I had a drone and tripod. So I think the overreaction was really uncalled for. They were very harsh, abusive. Short of being physically abusive, but they did try to take our equipment from us. I think the main thing in our mind, both of us, me and my cameraman, was that we did not want to relinquish our equipment. So we held on to it very tightly and they were very upset with that. So finally, after about 40 minutes or so, they told us that you can't go anywhere. You know, you better just surrender, you know, surrender your equipment. I said, no, this equipment, I cannot surrender to you, you know. This is very expensive equipment. We are doing our job as journalists. We are not here to harm the forest or poach it in any way. We are covering this for public interest. This is an important issue. And we haven't done anything wrong, you know. But after about half an hour, 40 minutes or 45 minutes, I can't remember, maybe an hour, I told them that if you take my equipment, you must give it back to me by the end of the day, you know. And finally, we surrendered and they handcuffed us, took our equipment. And they were very careful, actually. They tagged all our equipment. And I told them it's very expensive stuff. If any of it breaks, I'm going to sue you. So they actually let us carry our own equipment.
So what did you want it for? Did they go through what's in it?
Yeah, every single thing. They open up all our bags, they label everything. What is this? Battery, label battery. What is this? It's a propeller of the drone. Okay, what is it? Everything, they labeled it down. And then they put it all in a bag, and then we carried it, our equipment. The thing that they wanted was the SD card, the memory card. So my cameraman managed to negotiate with them that we copy all the contents, and then they can have that as barang bukti, as an evidence. So they have my SD card.
I think, according to media reports, there were more than 20 officials who were surrounding you. And because you were in the middle of, I guess, in the forest, they could do anything they want. And were you filming through the entire process as they were talking to you?
We couldn't, yeah. Couldn't. Because they immediately asked us to put down the camera. Yeah. So we only managed to film while they were walking up towards us with their hands, like, stop filming, stop filming. Mm. So we didn't have all that. But it was very intimidating to have 20, 30 men surrounding us. And there's just nothing you could do. And I think at that point, I felt totally helpless. Totally, like, I felt like I could not do anything. They could do anything to me if they wanted to.
Were you prepared for this?
You know, actually, when I did this story, I did not think that it was a dangerous story to do because we went in at a time after 3 months. I mean, the first 2 months of the blockades was when it was there was a lot of conflict, the gangsters came, there was standoff, you know. We went there. We came at a peaceful time. So I didn't expect this because a lot of the local reporters have gone in and out filming. None of them have been arrested. And, you know, they didn't get any permits. They just went in and out. So I didn't think it was a dangerous story to do, simply also because we were just in a forest filming some of the villagers and Orang Aslis. And also, I also notified them a week or two before that I was going to do this story, the forestry department. And I asked permission to interview the director of the forestry department. And I told them that we'll be happy to follow your officers in their daily activities. And we are doing a story about deforestation in Kelantan. So all this was made known to them officially, official letters.
Did you get a response from them?
The response that we got from them was, we don't have time. We don't have time, or maybe this date, or maybe there was no certainty. And we didn't know when we were ever going to get this. And we had such a short deadline. But when we were arrested, it seems as if that they knew, because from the letters, yeah? And they were following us. I mean, I just find that that's really, you know, I mean, why were they following journalists who were doing their jobs, you know?
So what happened in the end? Were you ever charged? Was any official charge leveled against you and your colleague, your cameraman?
Not yet. It has been 3 months already. And every month, for the last 2 months, we've had to go to Kelantan, the forestry department, to have our warranty papers stamped. So we have done that twice, which is very inconvenient. We have to fly there and it's a whole day gone and come back. Just to have a 5 minute stamp, you know. So we have to do it this month. But last month we asked them, are you all charging us? You know, is there any charges leveled against us? Because the investigation papers have been completed. But they haven't given us an answer. So this is the third month. If they have not charged us, that means it's finished. They cannot extend it anymore. So I don't know yet whether they're going to charge us or not. We'll see.
I'm speaking today to Jules Ong, a freelance journalist on this World Press Freedom Day. After the break, I'll ask Jules about how the journalism bug bit him. You're listening to BFM 89.9. You're listening to Live and Learn. I'm Chua Antek. My guest today is Jules Ong, a freelance journalist who documented the plight of the Tamil community setting up blockades against the logging companies in Kelantan. Just one thing that I wanted to pick up on before we went on the break was that you were saying how in the forest you felt like they could do anything to you. And as a freelance journalist, without that institutional backing from a company, did you feel extra vulnerable?
At that time, at that moment, I didn't think about that. Yeah. But after that, I'm like, yeah, actually, as a freelance journalist, I'm not covered. The company that hired me, they're under no legal obligation, actually, to protect me. It's good that they do, and they should, but I think going through the contract, they're not really duty-bound, and I think that's what freelance journalists face. Yeah.
Because also when you're writing letters, without that, I guess, the institutional weight behind you, are you less likely to be taken seriously?
When I'm commissioned by a media agency, I use actually the company letter to apply for permission. Okay. So also the letter that says that I've been contracted by them over this certain period of time, and please give your cooperation to me as a media practitioner on behalf of the company.
So I was reading you were trained in anthropology, and what did you do before turning to journalism?
Actually, my first degree was in biology. It was wildlife biology, ecology, and animal behavior. I used to hate people. So I didn't want to do anything with people. I wanted to learn and be with animals. But one stint in the studying this red ruffed lemurs and for the whole summer, and that made me question, oh, do I want to spend like my whole life just studying about animals? Like every 5 minutes I have to document them, like what they're doing, like maybe scratching themselves, sleeping, yawning, cuffing each other, and then finally have a very short conclusion about, I mean, I was asking myself, like, okay, do you want to spend your life doing that, or you want something more from that? So after my biology degree, I think because of a course that I took, it's called an Environment, Population, Hunger from Dr. Mirav Mehta in my college, that made me realize that a lot of the problems in the world, you'd have to dive into the marketplace and not isolate yourself. And I thought, what better way to dive myself in the marketplace than being a journalist? You know, I feel like, to bring awareness, to make people be able to imagine what it's like to be another person's shoes, to tell people stories about the environment. It's the journalism career is a very powerful career, very powerful medium of doing that.
And because you come into the trade relatively late, what kinds of training did you have to go for or seek in order to do it?
I didn't have any formal training, actually. I did not take any media course or journalism course. I just dived into it. My first job was with the Sun Papers, special issues, when Stephen Gunn of Malaysia Kini Now, he was my boss. I remember we met each other in a Bakun Dam demonstration, and then we had a chat and said, oh, we're looking for a reporter. Do you want to come for an interview? He asked me. And then the following week, I was from Penang, and then I went down to KL. And I remember we sat in a mamak shop, and then we had a one-hour interview. And then he just asked me, when would you like to start? I said, oh, really? Okay, maybe next week. So from a biology degree, boom, I was writing. Yeah. I was writing and reporting for special issues. And it was very difficult in the first 6 months. Totally different, also because I was very shy, you know.
Issues mean? What were you covering?
Special issues is current affairs features of the Section 2, kind of like a Section 2 of the Sun Papers. So back then, I remember, the Section 2 of the Sun Papers was more popular than the main paper. And people actually go for the Section 2 because we have very good features. And at the time, 1996, Reformasi era, the Sun Papers was not a free paper. It was like a new, fresh, young, brave paper, you know. So very exciting times at that time. So that's when I joined. That's when I started my journalism career.
So because of that interview, you became from a researcher into a journalist overnight.
After my degree, my biology degree, I didn't know what to do with myself. I came back from the States, and then I was doing organic farming in Balik Pulau in Penang with Organic Ong. So I was doing that for like 6 months. And I was writing a lot to the papers because I was feeling like, I need to speak. I need to say something about the situation here. I was writing a lot of papers, like letters to the editors and all that. And
what were you commenting about? The environment?
Oh, like at that time, there was this aqua culture. It was a big thing then. You know, tiger prawn farming and all that, you know. And I was like, my God, this is so polluting. It's terrible. So I was writing all this. We shouldn't go into aquaculture, into prawn farming, you know, and a lot of other environmental issues. And then my mother was, she's like, look, you went to the States, you studied, you come back and you're a farmer. And you're writing a lot to the papers. Why don't you get paid while writing to the papers? So I said, oh, good idea.
Right.
So that's how I became a journalist.
And these days, is documentary your main form of journalism?
Yes, it is. Yes, I started with print, was writing, and then photojournalism. I took my own pictures, and then I did radio. I learned from writing to audio. I was a correspondent for Jakarta 68H radio station for a year, and then I decided that I want to do visual. Video, and since then, that's kind of 10 years already, 10, 12 years. that I've been doing production, TV production.
What do you find rewarding about it? Why do you gravitate towards visual compared to print or radio?
Yeah, I mean, I still do miss print, actually, writing, because it's so different, yeah. Print, writing, you're alone, yeah. Quite a lonely journey, and it's nice, that feeling too. And you can kind of blend into a situation and observe and write your own thoughts, reflections, interview people. But production, no way. You're a crew. Main difference is you have to work as a team. You know, you have your cameraman, you have your sound man. And then post-production, you're writing the script, you work with the editor, you know, your producer, your executive producer. So it's really a teamwork. But what I love about documentaries is that because of the visual medium that is so powerful, the visual and the sounds. And I think human beings, we are very visual creatures, you know, that move us. I think that the capacity to, as a mass media, to attract people, to make people reflect, there's so much potential in documentary films, I mean, now in film medium, I mean, there are people who read and there are many, many people who don't read, you know. Just nowadays, it's just smartphones, everything's on YouTube, you know.
Could it be argued that they're reading a lot more, just that it's not maybe long form? Because they're on their smartphones, I don't know, 40 to 150 times a day, according to research. Right. So they're reading all these bite-sized listicles or, you know, clickbait articles, but they're not reading maybe a traditional mainstream newspaper.
Yeah, I think now everything is bite-sized.
Even
now,
the videos, you have to
condense it. It's very short, yeah. Mm-hmm. But now, like my son, he doesn't read. He just watch YouTube one after another, you know. And even if you do read, it's very short, and it's more like talking, you know, talking to people, social media kind of reading. You know? So still, the visual format is still all powerful in this world.
I mean, I can definitely relate to what you said earlier about wanting to, you know, stay away from humans and work with animals, because I studied literature in college, and so I like the written word. And so that's my preferred mode of, I guess, expressing myself in work or in other things. And so when you're working, for example, on a story, and it's just you and the story, you pursue everything you need to do it, you present it in that way, and you are the director, the screenwriter, everything, the producer of it. But if you are working on a documentary, the story is just one aspect of this big machine, right? You have to manage the people, you are the director, you're the manager, you're the producer, you have to take into account of all these other things, which is not just the story. So do you find that a distraction, or do you enjoy it more?
Still, as the director, you do have a lot of say in how you want a story to be. So that is satisfying, in that I think documentaries, like writing too, is about storytelling. You tell a good story, you know, it works. It's a good story. The thing is that, yes, you have to work, like, for example, with the music. You know, you can choose your music, but sometimes your producers will say, okay, I think this fits better. You know, and then you have to be humble to defer to other people whose strength is that audio-wise, you know. So I think it's a humbling experience doing television, simply because you work with a whole bunch of people who have different strengths, who have more talents than you do in other aspects of it. A lot of directors also, they may script it, but they have a writer to write it out for them, the script. So I might say, okay, I want the story to be like this. Usually I script myself. I just feel more in control of the story. But actually doing this story, Fighting for My Home, was the first time where I had another writer doing the script for me, because I was in the hospital for 2 weeks. I didn't have a choice. So she scripted Act 1 and Act 2, and then I scripted Act 3 and Act 4, you know. So fortunately, it came together quite well, I think. So your question about, does it distract me? It's, it doesn't distract me, as in I need to relinquish control a little bit more than, you know, writing the whole article myself, taking the pictures myself. I need to relinquish control. And then I realized that it's actually, you have a better product, better story when I do that. Let's say if I were to film it myself and edit it myself and script it myself, you, as a director, you tend to want, if you film it yourself, you tend to want everything, because, oh, this is so beautiful, I want this to be in. But if you have another pair of eyes, like my editor would tell me, this doesn't work, chop. What? I want that in. No, it doesn't work.
Yes.
It doesn't work.
Because you feel too precious,
right,
about
it. You're right. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. So it's actually good to have that in TV.
So are you inclined towards some stories, since now you're a freelance journalist, you get to decide what you want to pursue on? Are you more inclined towards stories about marginalized communities, like the one that you just work on?
Yeah, in a way, I kind of gravitate towards stories about marginalized communities, vulnerable communities, simply because I feel that they do not have the means or the platform to get their voices heard. And I think that's where I want to tell their stories, you know. Part of my other job for my income is fixing and producing for international broadcasters. So that kind of job, I do not have much say as in they want to do a story, let's say, and then they need my help to produce it. So I can affect the stories in my suggestions, or the, you know, provide them with the nuances of the stories, of the local nuances, this person you should speak to. But when I do a documentary that like the one I did, I have I pitched the story and it was accepted, and then the stories that I pitched, it's about the Orang Aslis. The previous one was about the refugees, Rohingya refugees, and I, it gives me satisfaction that people can watch the film and feel like, you know, ah, this is the life of people there. They can step in their shoes for one day, you know, to know their issues.
How do you earn the trust of the subject that you want to work a story on?
How do I earn the trust? A lot of times it's through friends, you know. So this is the friend that they trust, and then I'm the friend. So that immediately there's kind of a trust going on. But I think to earn the trust, you have to be a good listener, and you have to be humble. I think to be a good listener is a journalist trait. It's like, you know, the old proverb that says, if you want knowledge, you cannot be higher. It's like water pouring down. The bowl cannot be higher than the pitcher. And you want to be in a humble position to listen to their story, because it's their story that you're telling.
Have you gotten into any trouble, legal or otherwise, while doing a story prior?
You mean before this one, yeah, that I got into trouble? Well, I was actually arrested in Myanmar for being in the... that was way back, 1998. I interviewed Aung San Suu Kyi, actually, at that time, and was also in the democratic activism of sharing solidarity with the Myanmar people in 1998, in commemoration of the 10-year anniversary of the 1988 massacre. And I was arrested with a bunch of others, 18 of us, for 10 days, and then we were released. So that was the other experience, but it's not so much associated with my journalism efforts. It was more an activism. But at the same time, it was because of my interest with the Myanmar democratic struggle at that time. And of course, now it's very different. Aung San Suu Kyi also has is now quite a controversial figure now.
Backtrack, or not really backtrack, as not as vocal as she could be on certain issues.
Yeah, we felt that, oh, we went into jail for her, and now look at what's happening with the Rohingya people. Now a lot of my work actually is with the Rohingya refugees. We started a school for them in Selayang, part of my job outside of my journalistic efforts.
So this life that you lead, this vocation of being a freelance journalist, for people listening, maybe aspiring students, how would you characterize it? Because it seems dangerous. It could be unstable. But is the reward worth it, especially if you are a freelance journalist operating in this region?
I think there are many types of journalists you can be. You can be very safe writing features of fashion or food, you know. And then if you want to do more hard-hitting stories, yeah, there are plenty, you know. So you choose what kind of journalist you want to be. But the common thread is, of course, as journalists, you want to tell the truth, you know. And not many people want the truth to be out. So hence, that's the danger of it. I think it's a very rewarding career, being a journalist. Even though there are many constraints in the media environment in Malaysia, but still, it makes you creative. It makes you creative how to, quote-unquote, exploit the loopholes. I know when I was working with the Star papers and the Sun papers, there were many things that you cannot report in the main paper, but you can talk about it in the feature articles, and that's where, you know, those things happen. Even, I think, up to today, if you read Section 2, they tend, if they're writing about environmental stories, or they tend to be more hard-hitting, you know, whereas in the main paper, it's mostly reportage, you know. It's a scribe reporting. So I feel there are a lot of things you could do, actually. And then you could come out and be a freelance journalist. It's not easy, actually. It's possible after you have your contacts, after, you know. For me, after working about 10 years in the local industry, and then also with Al Jazeera, and I have my contacts, then I can come out confidently to do my own thing.
The documentary is called Fighting for My Home, and it's available to stream for free on channelnewsasia.com. We'll include a link on our website once this interview is podcasted. Do check it out. Jose, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe.
You've been listening to Live and Learn, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.